welcome to this week's edition of Books and Booze. We are once again being brought to you by the upcoming anthology Long Distance Drunks, a tribute to Charles Bukowski. We are here with Nick Mamatas, author of Love is the Law, as well as a number of other things. This is Renee, and I am drinking coffee this evening because I am exhausted. Nick, how are you doing?
What
are you
drinking tonight? I'm doing great. I'm drinking a Tim's Cup, Tim's number one.
Ah, Tim's Cup.
Tell me what that is.
I know what it is.
It's a British drink.
No, go ahead.
An English drink.
Yeah.
And it's basically, well, there are seven different kinds of Tim's or six different kinds of Tim's, but Tim's Cup number one is kind of like gin, like a citrusy gin.
Ah.
And a proper
I've
Tim's
read
cup
about it in
Tim's.
Books, but I never knew what it was.
Yeah. It's a summertime drink in the United Kingdom. And so it's Tim's or lemon and lemon soda or lemonade or ginger ale, how I have it, and some fruit and cucumbers. So I've got Tim's number one with ginger ale and strawberries and an orange and a cucumber in the glass.
Oh, wow.
A fantastic thing to drink if you want to get day drunk.
Absolutely. Because it's gin, it sneaks up on you. And because it's nice and fruity and sweet, it feels like you're drinking lemonade or something.
Well, and it is, I mean, it's relatively low alcohol content. I got introduced to it hanging out with my in-laws because they're in England. And I came home, I brought bottles of Pimm's for everyone I knew on the way back. So we had it. Anyway, Jessica, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking PBR. Would anyone like to ask me what that is?
What is that?
Is it Pabst Blue Ribbon or something else?
It stands for the Pabst Blue Ribbon, and it is. It was selected as America's best beer in 1893.
Things were different then.
It was a stiff competition that year, I've heard.
Yeah. But in 1893, it was the best. Moving forward.
I love that. That reminds me of, like, on Lucky Strike boxes, it still says LSMFT, which stands for Lucky Strike means fine tobacco.
Well, it does.
Apparently it does.
I guess. I don't know.
I don't know either.
They still made Lucky Strike.
They do. Anyway. Like I said, we were going to start out. So here's an interesting story.
Oh.
I've been seeing your name around a lot, Nick. And I was at the bookstore looking for a birthday gift for my brother-in-law. And I bought him the year's best science fiction and fantasy 2013. And I saw your name on there and I was like, hey, I know a lot of people who know that guy. And then before I actually gave it to him, we booked the interview. So when he opened it, I was like, yeah, I'm going to interview that guy. And I used it to make myself sound more important than I really am. So thank you for that.
Oh, no problem. And it sounds great, right? But there are actually like five or six different year's best anthologies for science fiction and fantasy.
Really?
Well, this was the only one at my bookstore. Literally the only
one. It's the only one I've ever been in, so it's great that it happened that way. But
right. But you were in good company, though.
Yeah.
Wasn't there a story by Ursula Le Guin in that one?
Oh, now you're going to make me look on my shelf for it, man. Oh, here it is.
I would look on my shelf, but like I said, the bookstore literally only had one copy, and I gave it away.
Yeah, Le Guin, Kelly Link, Catherine Valente. Lots of good people in this one, I guess.
Yeah. You could definitely be in worse company.
Nobody ever reads the anthologies they're in. When I was, you know, first starting out, I'd get an anthology. Oh, I'm going to read all these great stories that are, you know, my table of contents mates, and they realize, oh, my God, I'm in here by some kind of fluke. These stories are freaking awful. Not in this case. I'm sure they're all fine. This year is best. But in earlier anthologies, I was always somewhat shocked to with whom I was appearing, you know.
Isn't that I think that's the worst, like, in either direction almost. Like, if you feel like you're the worst one in there, that's a kind of special feeling. And then if you feel like, ooh, I might
be the best
one in
there.
That's still both are pretty awkward feelings. Although I'm sure you don't often feel like the worst.
That's true.
See?
On a scale of 1 to 10.
Nine point eight eight seven five.
Oh, yes. Good answer. Yeah. So, but and then you also were you also had a story in Best American Mystery Stories of 2013.
So that one is a big deal. That's a big deal. Best American.
Yeah, edited by Lisa Scottolini, which is did I say that wrong? I think I did.
I
anyway,
that's how I say it.
Okay, good. Which you know she's kind of a big deal. You could do worse, right?
Yeah.
Oh wait, you know what? You said that you were only in the year's Best Science Fiction and Fantasy of 2013, but wasn't that story also in the year's Top 10 Tales of Science Fiction?
Yes, but that wasn't a book. That's actually a collection of CDs. That's an audio company.
That's cool.
And so when that CD came out, I realized, I don't have a CD player.
Oh, no.
Oh, I'll put it into my computer. I mean, my computer no longer has a CD player. I get
really?
To call my neighbor a CD player to listen to this, yeah.
Good grief.
That is weird. Not even in your car, huh?
I actually don't have a car. Olivia has a car. But I thought
like
strange going out there. I don't even drive. So it's been strange to go on and have Olivia, my wife, turn on the car and leave, plug into my CD of myself. In a car, in a parking lot, or in a driveway.
There you go. So did you record it, or somebody else recorded it?
Oh, someone else. It was definitely professionally recorded by somebody else.
You're like, definitely not me. That's really
absolutely
cool.
Not me. On the rare occasions I've had things podcasted where they've asked me, oh, do you want to record something? I'm like, oh, God, no.
Really?
I'm glad we didn't ask.
So Tor.com, for example, want authors to podcast or they even said, oh, we don't really care if it's not professional. We just want them to know who you are. I said, you don't want them to know who I am. I got my friend to record the story.
Pay someone to do that, yeah.
So is that reflective of your attitude about live readings as well?
Yes. I mean, partly it's that I talk too fast. I'm talking kind of slow for me now because I've been drinking this Pimm's Cup for a while. It's actually my third. I was sort of gearing up for the show. But usually I talk very quickly, and when I read even more quickly. And I decided recently to stop reading at all. I went to go see Ian Rankin the other day when he was here in town supporting his new book. And he didn't read. He just talked about Edinburgh and his experience as a writer and, like, the little anecdotes. And I asked him afterward, I was online getting the book signed. I said, oh, it's great that you're reading. Well, I can't read. One, I'm not good at it. Two, I'm a mystery writer. I don't read the first couple pages. You're going to start knowing things you shouldn't be knowing.
Right.
So I decided I'll never read again. And I figured, I will also do that. I will be like Ian Rankin. So now I'm no more readings. When I have events, I'm just going to have like a little anecdote routine or a comedy routine instead of a reading.
That works. That could be really cool, though.
Yeah.
You know, we had Joe Clifford on the show, and I was talking to him at a reading after that. And I was saying that I've never done one, and they kind of make me nervous. They freak me out. And he said, you know how everyone tells you that it gets easier? And I was like, yeah, it doesn't get easier. It's exactly as terrible every time. So I felt like that was really uplifting.
Jeez. I don't want to hear that.
I know, right? Joe Clifford, dream crusher. Anyway,
and he's a pretty good reader. I've met him. He lives around here, and I've met him a couple of times. And he runs this reading event, Lip Service West. He's a pretty good reader. He gets good readers, and he still loves it, But so I'm just someone who doesn't really care about reading, trying to do it.
Yeah,
it's just impossible. Why? Because you spend years trying to become a writer and become a writer, and say, okay, now be an actor.
Exactly. I think it takes a certain personality to be good at those live readings and to engage the audience and that kind of thing. Because I've heard some great writers that are horrible to listen to live, which is painful because they're just not good.
I've unfortunately witnessed that as well. But this is how I feel. I have done stage acting. I still feel like reading my own work is way worse. Like they always tell you to read your stuff out loud. I don't even like reading it out loud to myself.
No, I agree. Whenever I'm reading out loud, especially at a reading, I keep thinking, oh, my God, who wrote this shit? Well, I better just get it done, and I speed up even more. on the rare occasions I've been called upon to read somebody else's writing, I should be okay.
I feel, yeah, I think it is. It's something like specifically about having it be your own work and not necessarily the act of reading out loud.
Yeah, definitely.
So,
sort of like peeing in front of everybody.
I've never heard it phrased quite that way, but I feel like that's really great.
Yeah, it has own your truth, doesn't it? Yeah, it definitely
does. The difference is that you might genuinely be in a position where you do need to pee in front of everybody. But you are never going to be in a situation where your body is forcing you to read in front of everybody.
Absolutely.
And so,
yes.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's like hostage situations you don't know about.
Right, with a gun to your head. Read now.
And of course, you know, people do come to see you read. Right? They're there to be entertained by you. Nobody's going to say, oh, Nick's going to go pee tonight. Let's go see and pee.
True.
Yes.
You win that one, yeah. You've edited quite a few anthologies, haven't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And different publications.
I sure have. Yep.
Oh.
Last year, I have a day job where I'm editor, and we did an anthology called The Future of Japanese, which was Japanese writing and translation, and also American or Western writers writing on Japanese themes, you know, for the science, futuristic science fiction. And it did okay, and we got a Hugo Award, Mono no Aware, by Ken Liu, won the Hugo Award, which is exciting. And we're doing another one called Phantasm Japan, which will be the same concept, but that just means it is science fiction, and we're working on that now.
And do you find yourself really enjoying the process of working on anthologies and seeing other people's work, or is it really stressful?
No, it's my favorite thing. If I could do anthologies full time or just do dozens of anthologies, I would love to do so. And right now, it's receding now, but we're in a golden moment of anthologies where there are many more coming out than there have been. And different concepts of anthologies, you know, these gigantic form book size anthologies have really brought back to the short story, and the anthology is a venue for the short story. And right now, it's fading away. You can tell when short story anthologies that have a lot of good writers in it are getting kickstarted instead of published. You can tell things are fading, but for a while, it was going really well, and I was very excited to be in a lot of anthologies. I love reading short stories. You know, often writers will say, oh, you know, I put like a blog post saying, you know, young writer, don't send your favorite writer a short story like me. I don't want to read your short story. When people often ask me, you know, it's out of the blue, oh, will you read my short story? Sure, I'd love to read your story.
Hmm.
And I love reading your story. Especially when it's horrible, to be perfectly honest, especially when it's awful. And I like drawing a line where I would have stopped had I been just a consumer or an editor, and I love explaining what's wrong with the story or trying to fix the story. That's why I like teaching classes. You know, I teach classes at Lit Reactor and here at a place called the Writing Salon, an MFA program. I just like reading stories.
The only time that I like really – I used to do some – accepting and rejecting, and the only time I like reading the bad ones is when they're almost good and I feel like I can give input to help. When it's just bad, it's like, oh, I hate this job and I don't want to be the person to tell you no, but I really genuinely have to tell you no because this is not good. It makes me feel terrible.
I guess I love telling people no. It doesn't make me feel terrible. Just on Facebook, we're having this conversation about Byron Quartermass. I think that's how you pronounce his last name, Quartermass. Who is now reading, was an editor for Exhibit A, which is a crime fiction imprint, if I get this all right. I don't know if it is. He was saying, oh, well, the best part of my job is sending out acceptance letters. The worst part, sending out rejection letters. Like, nope, for me, it's reversed.
Well, that's awesome. Well, you said about anthologies, and I've always heard, like, if you do an anthology, no one's ever going to pick it up. It's never, unless it's like a self-published Kickstarter thing, it's never going to see the light of day. Nobody wants to work with a short story anthology because they don't sell, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So do you think that is true, or is that something that people should
that
take
was
more
true
of a shot
for
on
a long
anthology?
Time? And what happened was that John Joseph Adams really, I think, came up with the concept of doing a gigantic phone book anthology of reprints with a couple, with one or two new stories. He did it with a book called Wastelands and the Living Dead, which, you know, tapped into the zombie wave at the same time. And people realized, oh, we can sell these things. And they get sold now, like nonfiction. Because there are people who walk into the bookstores and say, you got any, what is steampunk? You got, what is that steampunk? And now, but a store employee can say, steampunk, huh? Here's a book full of steampunk, and it's an anthology of steampunk. And so there's a huge increase in anthologies, and people who have not anthologized, worked as an anthologist for many years, like John Skip, who in the 80s had anthologies, and has come back and has done anthologies with zombies and demons and werewolves and psychos, you know, I mean, two of them. Prime Books.
So it works primarily well, like an introductory thing.
Exactly, or like a survey, because they'll have, you know, the old story from the 19th century, then stories from the middle of the 20th century, then contemporary stories. And, you know, The Living Dead, which I am not in, but I had a couple of friends in, sold well enough that everyone got a royalty check for
$1,500. Oh, wow. Wow, that is really good.
But not just Stephen King or anything like that, but people who you've never heard of, who sold the story for a penny a word as a reprint, a year later got, you know, what a small person paid for a novel.
What I think, too, I guess, like zombies are huge right now. There might be people who aren't normally big readers who are like, I want more than The Walking Dead and the most recent zombie movie. They're going to be more likely to pick up an anthology where they can sort of flip around and read it, you know, read it on the train on the way to work.
Exactly right. Yeah. And we're seeing that a lot. I mean, the other thing is also that these days it's easy to self-publish a novel. So if you're a medium-sized publisher, the question is, well, why would I publish for you when I can publish myself and keep all the royalties for myself? Ha, ha, ha. Now, there are reasons to do so, absolutely, but there are also reasons not to do so. But an anthology is hard to get together and, like, put on Kindle yourself with your 18 friends. So publishers sort of stepped in and sort of started taking anthology more seriously and finding more saleable ideas and putting better cover art on them and spending a little bit more money getting them together. And I think it's really shown up. The last few years have been huge for anthologies. What I think is not useful is if people with sort of like a dumb idea. And have no idea what a good writer is, you know.
Yeah.
And so they throw in anybody, or they throw in somebody they think is a big name who is no longer a big name, or who is a big name but is also terrible at short stories because they're a good novelist but a great terrible short story writer, and those don't really work very well. And they don't know how to professionally approach a publisher, so they can be a huge challenge, of course, because there's plenty of competition out there, plenty of editors who are great at doing anthologies. But right now, it's still pretty good territory doing anthology. If you have the right idea, and if you're the right person who can use the right sort of eye for stories.
That is interesting. That is, like, honestly, that is all information that for right now, before right now.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's just, like, operating on old news, basically.
Yeah. It's a problem. Things change faster than the news gets around, because people... You know, who do you listen to about writing advice? Ask somebody who was big when you were a kid.
True.
Or somebody who was big when you were a kid has the information from the 70s or 80s in their brain. And they may not have adapted to what's going on now in the 20-teens.
That's a really good point.
And in 10 years, I may have no idea what's going on. I may be, oh, yeah, there's an anthology out there. It's in that Borders bookstore. They can sell a lot of books. I may be stupid in a few years. It's a possibility.
In 10 years, you will sound like a 20s radio actor.
That's right.
At your prediction. So I guess we kind of skipped around a little bit, but one of the things I wanted to ask when we were talking about the best science fiction and best American mysteries was to ask what genre you feel the most warm and fuzzy in when you're writing. Like, where are you the most confident and at home?
Wow, that's a good question, and it's sort of a question that I've been not struggling with, because I never struggle with anything. I just change my mind a lot. so for years, I started publishing a lot of fantasy and some science fiction, and then a lot of horror. Although, of course, if you know, look at the reviews, you would say, this is not a horror story. What's this mama stuff doing, fucking around, you know, fapping off in these pages? Where's the intestines and the main background and that kind of thing? So I was just sort of a little out of place there. And I decided a few years ago to start writing crime fiction. And the problem is, of course, that there's many fewer venues for short crime fiction than there's for short fantasy and science fiction. So I'm working on a novel, and I've put out my first novel. It's mostly a crime novel and that sort of thing. But at the same time, I always think to myself, what I really want is for people to know who Nick Mamatas is and what his stories are all about. And a couple of years ago, I was reading the website sfsignal.com, which does what they call mind melds, where they ask, say, 10 different writers, some question. Sometimes the questions are good, and sometimes the questions are stupid. And sometimes the answers are good, and sometimes the answers are dumb. And one of the stupid questions was, so how would you feel if science fiction was more popular? Which is a dumb question. Because, of course, everyone who writes science fiction would be what?
Really happy.
They'd be happy, right. And the dumb answer is, I'll be happy because if people like science fiction better, they would like me better.
Right.
And that's a dumb
right.
answer because what you're saying is, I'm offering nothing in particular other than the fact that I write in the genre.
Hmm.
You know, you're basically saying, I'm a generic example of the genre, and so if people like the genre, they're going to like me. And I don't want to be generic example of anybody. I want to be myself. So part of my struggles is trying to find venues to publish short fiction and to publish books that are my books that can't be written by anybody else that are going to be what I want them to be, but still find a place where they can be purchased in a store, where somebody can walk into a store and happen to find a book with my name in it.
Right.
You know.
Go
ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I think that's the mark of the kind of stuff that hardcore readers respond to, I guess, is when someone goes, well, what kind of book is it? And you're like, it's really hard to explain, but it's really fantastic, so you should read it. Because
right,
if you can just say flat out, oh, it's hard science fiction, it's got spaceships.
Yes.
Yeah.
What were you
and there are two kinds of hardcore readers, right? There's a hardcore reader who likes that stuff. Like, I want spaceships. I want Greek millionaires and their angry secretaries. I want werewolf boyfriends. And they get all that stuff. But then you have the hardcore reader like us and why I wanted to be on your show and why I approached to be on the show because I enjoy your who you have on. Like you have Molly Panzer and Craig Clivenger and all these different people who I like who are all over the place.
Yeah.
So I thought, these are the people who I want to know me,
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing I'm after. That audience is what I'm after. People who are aesthetic explorers. They'll read science fiction and crime. But I have people ask me, oh, do you like this? So, they'll say, well, do you read this book? Like, I stopped reading it. Like, why? Because it was bad. But it's just a popcorn novel. Like, I don't have time for popcorn novels. If I want brain candy, I watch TV. I watch wrestling. I watch 14 hours of professional wrestling a week. I'm not even joking. But I won't read a bad book. I only want to read the best 3% of every genre. Amish romance, But I don't read a mediocre book in the genres I love the best.
I feel like
that's
something
people I want to read.
I don't know if it happened just because I got older and faced my mortality or if it happened because I started committing myself to reading avidly again, where I hit that point too, where I used to be a compulsive finisher. Like, it doesn't matter how bad it is, I have to finish it. I read 3 of the Twilight books because once I read the first one, to feel entitled to make fun of it, I was like, well, now I have to finish it. And it was like this huge breakthrough for me to refuse to read the 4th one, even though everybody
said, woman.
You got to read them. Like, my mom, I was bitching about them. It's so terrible, and blah, 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 blah. She's like, you don't have to keep reading it.
Yeah,
but I do. But now, when a book sucks, I'm like, yeah.
I had a lot right over your shoulder. There's no time to waste. Life is too short. We can't read every good book in the world in our lifetime, not even in English. Forget, like, learning French or learning Spanish or learning Mandarin. You find really good books there. It's impossible. So there's no reason for us to ever read a bad book. Right?
True.
I feel like I already know what you're going to say about this, but I just want to put it out there.
Tell me the question and the answer, and we'll see how it goes.
How do you feel about branding as an author, since you genre hop and do all that?
Am I talking to Jessica? Is that right? The accent is Jessica? Okay.
Yes.
So just go, what do you think my answer will be?
I think you're going to respond negatively to the idea of branding.
That is correct. Jessica, you got it right.
Yay.
I don't like branding. I mean, on one level, obviously, I have a sort of a brand. Let's be honest here. I got this blog that people like to used to read a lot back when blogging was big, and people say, oh, that's that guy who's a jerk on the internet, and There's that guy who writes those stories that are really strange, and it's like Lovecraft meets, you know, whatever famous person. He feels like going in there. So yeah, on one level I've got a brand. On another level, I'm just trying to be what I like to be, which is what I'm interested in. So I'm interested in Marxism and professional wrestling and my baby and, you know, making fun of flyers I see on the streets. So I just put out anything out there. I'm not thinking about how am I developing my brand or whatnot.
I want to read a book where you combine all of those interests into one novel. If you could do that, yeah. I would buy 10 copies.
It's tricky. But I do have a story about professional wrestling coming out. And I've been working on it, or thinking about working on it for 15 years. So I wanted to write it in carny / wrestling lingo, in the secret dialect of the carnival workers and the wrestlers.
Oh my God.
I finally had the opportunity to do so, and that's going to be in a book called Nightmare Carnival that Ellen Dotlow is editing. And mostly it's fantasy, like dark fantasies about the carnival and the circus. But mine's just a noir story about carnival professional wrestling. So that's cool.
That sounds cool, and the anthology sounds really cool, so that's a win.
Yeah.
So we want to make sure we have some time to discuss the book, because it was a lot of fun. Both of us really, really enjoyed it. And I guess I'll just start in the order of my notes, and Jessica and I will try not to interrupt each other, because there's a lot.
Well, I'll tell you what, Renee, let's do one thing first. Let's tell your listeners out there the name of the book is Love is the Law.
Oh.
So they can buy it. And
right.
Let's also tell them that the book is $7.99.
What we always do as well in the episode notes of every episode, the book will be linked. And not only will it be linked, but it'll be the easiest thing for you to find, because it'll be the one that is a picture instead of a text link. And you just click the picture.
Oh, that's great.
And it takes you right to Amazon. You can buy the book. So,
oh, Amazon, huh?
Well,
it's the law.
Okay. All right.
So
by the way, I'm a total lightweight. I don't know if you realize this as far as my alcohol consumption goes. I do not drink very often.
Well, we're honored that you're doing it with us.
Oh, no problem. Olivia, so do you want to fake it? I say, no, I don't want to fake it. I want to have a drink.
Cool, because we do get people who don't drink asking us if they should lie. And it's always like,
oh,
no, please don't. Like, it's not, we're not peer pressuring people. You can drink. This isn't, we're not rushing a fraternity. It's okay.
Yeah. We're not going to call you any horrible slur names. You don't have to do it. But yeah, it's always fun too.
Sorry. So you listed some of your interests. And Marxism is one of the heavier themes in the book. The protagonist, Dawn, is very interested in it and involved in it. But the other thing, is a lot of talk about Aleister Crowley, who, of course, is a major occult figure. And my first question is, did your interest in Crowley come before or as a result of Love is the Law?
I was interested in Crowley before. I mean, I wasn't hyper-interested in that. People, of course, you know, still are actively involved in doing occult rituals and, you know, see Crowley as a figure to emulate, and I was sort of interested in him as a phenomenon. And I've written short stories about him before, one called Summon, Bind, Banish, which is about his little life, and it ends up sort of a Felim life, you know, one of his worshippers contemplating his own life and that kind of thing. So he's just an interesting figure, and I guess I got interested in him partially because I read a lot of comic books from the 90s from Alan Moore and Grant Morrison, and they spoke about him a lot. And of course, if you're just like a nerdy, picked-on kid in high school and college, you gravitate toward these, you know, dubious figures. So I knew a little bit about him. He's interesting. You know, I don't truck with the occult. I don't think it does very much other than just sort of psychological game playing with your own mind, which is an important thing sometimes, but it's not. I don't believe in magic, is what I'm trying to say. So the issue is there predates the book, but I, you know, dug out all the old things I'd read and all of my old memories of his rituals and that kind of thing, and put it out there. I also started following several blogs of Crowleyites and seeing how they sort of interacted with the Crowley material today, which is pretty interesting as part of my research into the book.
I always think that the ritual things are as interesting. And like, I don't know, I was buying up a lot of used, like occult literature, cause I was researching something I ended up not doing, but my favorite one is I bought one.
What
it was
is the
a
book
guide.
You're writing or an occult thing you're going to do?
A book I was writing that I decided not to write.
Okay.
Because whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever. No, I wasn't really going to like
okay.
make a pact with a demon, but I did buy a book that was a guide on how to make a pact with a demon. And there was, I just looked this up because I don't know, it just occurred to me. I looked up the picture I took. There's a disclaimer in the front cover, and it's like the best thing I've ever read. This is inside the front cover of a book titled Making Pacts with Demons, okay? The authors in no way endorse, advocate, or recommend any practices in this book which are illegal. For those who wish to practice making pacts with demons, there are numerous legal ways to accomplish the practices described in this book without breaking any legal boundaries. Because that's your number one concern, right? Like, what if I'm breaking a county law?
If you're going to be a demon summoner, you definitely want to be an upstanding citizen.
Right. You don't want to get a citation.
Yeah. Who messed up the park with all this ghost blood? Was it you, Jerry? It was me. I was summoning demons. Sorry.
Oh, jeez.
Call me again.
So there are some heavy things in the novel as well. Your character, Dawn, doesn't lead a very charmed existence.
No. So just
we
to
have
viewers a little, the listeners a little bit. Basically, the story of Dawn Seliger. She's a young woman, 18 or 19 years old, living on Long Island. It's 1989. The Berlin Wall is collapsing. And she had a mentor named Bernstein, who was her mentor in both magic and Marxism. He was a very doctrinaire kind of Trotskyist. So while he didn't support the Soviet Union as socialists, he thought, oh, we have to defend the Soviet Union as a deformed worker state. So he was very nervous about what was going on in the late 80s with Glasnost and Perestroika and the opening of the Berlin Wall and people leaving Hungary and that kind of thing. And then he turns up dead. And so Dawn decides that she's going to try to find whoever it was who murdered Bernstein. And her life is not going very well. The peace dividend basically has led to her father getting laid off, and he has become a crack addict. Her mother is deceased. She lives with her grandmother, who is experiencing Alzheimer's disease, and they live off the grandmother's very paltry Social Security check. She's also a punk rocker, sort of very doctrinaire, yellow, big orange mohawk, slightly overweight punk rock girl, which in 1989, you may as well just, you know, be a pit bull with AIDS or something like that, because you were very much
That's great you said that.
To the side, yeah.
Because actually she's obliquely referred to as a pit bull with AIDS at one point in the novel.
Well, that was a very common sort of bumper sticker on Long Island at the time, where, you know, this property purchased by a pit bull with AIDS, because pit bulls were NIH were the two big sort of local news stories about the terrible things that were happening. AIDS was coming from the city, and pit bulls just killing kids, and we could, you know, had these unbeatable jaws. So the pit bull with AIDS was a big thing in Long Island in the 80s, sort of a totem of suburban paranoia.
I'm learning so much on this episode. But yeah, so I think, like, I mean, you know, basically Dawn is an orphan for all intents and purposes. She has some interaction with her father, but, you know, he's a crack addict, so
right.
It's not great.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, like, she's sort of purposely isolating herself from her peers. She participates in self-harm. Like, there's a lot of heavy stuff going on in here. And I guess what I wonder reading it is that she's a really intriguing character, and you're invested in her right away. But there's also a certain amount of humor in the way that she sees things and some of the things that she does and her interactions with her peers as she's, like, on this journey to solve this case are relatively normal teenage stuff. So I guess I want to know, when you're balancing these incredibly heavy themes, you know, parental drug abuse, self-harm, bullying, like all this crazy stuff, Alzheimer's, a teenager taking care of an elderly parental figure, and then also like, but really in a lot of ways, she is a normal teenage girl. How did you approach that? Especially because it's told from the first person. So like you really had to get in the head of that character and cover all of
these. And that's how you do it. That's how I do it. Well, I always, when I'm writing a story or writing a novel, I don't really do a lot of revision. I don't really do a lot of outlining. What I do is a lot of pre-composition, where I spend a lot of time thinking about the first sentence of the story. And often it's in first person, but it may emerge in third person. It may lead to a delayed first-person narrator, or, you know, revealing himself or herself pages in. But when I get that first sentence or that first bit of voice out, then I can say, okay, what's the voice going to tell me next? And that's how I follow things through. So Dawn surprised me with some of her antics as well. But I just thought, well, if the voice is believable, then even if she's extremely unusual, people will suspend their disbelief and believe in this girl. You know?
Yeah.
But she's not supposed to be a regular girl, or like, you know, if you think, well, I don't know any girls like that, of course you don't. Because of course you do that. You know.
Right.
But it doesn't matter. If you don't feel like her, you have to just believe for the 250 page or wherever it is that she's real. So it is, that's the Crowley-esque occult thing where you create a thought form in the head of the reader and it becomes real to them, or at least with the length of time of the book.
Oh.
And that's
now, I saw you describe her somewhere else as a strong female character who's essentially sociopath and also like Harriet the Spy. But
well, I think a strong female character was probably in sarcastic quotes or ironic quotes.
Oh, okay.
That's right. Because, of course, that's what people are talking about a lot now. I don't know if you follow science fiction blogs or mystery blogs.
We do, yeah.
Strong female characters. And, of course, a lot of them aren't all that strong. A lot of them aren't really all that female. And most of them aren't really characters. Right? They just have two or three traits, and they just burn through an adventure. So, really, when I pitched the books to my editor at Dark Horse, Rachel Adidin, our sort of thought was, how can we get rid of the scourge of the strong female character? What can we do to say, okay, we should stop now? And so Dawn was kind of a result of that. So, yeah, Harry the Spy is a book I love. The Long Secret, the sequel, I love even more, even though it's an inferior novel. In fact, if you were a PhD student and you wanted to write a thesis about any of this, you should read The Long Secret and Love is a Law at the same time.
Yeah.
They have many secret structural similarities for any would-be academics out there. And so... Yeah, so we were trying to think about, basically we were inspired by The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and more than even that book, people's reaction to the main character of that book.
Yeah.
She's, you know, sort of punk rock, but also very sexy, but also very violent, and she's a hacker. So on one level, she's really wish a film is. Like, oh, I wish I was a middle-aged, nerdy journalist, and a hot chick would come around and have sex with me and be crazy and violent and have a motorcycle. You know, who wouldn't want that? So we wanted to figure out, okay, what can we do and make this character like the worst part, where you're not going to say, I wish she'd have sex with me, because that's definitely not what anybody walks away from Love's Law thinking.
I was going to ask, though, how do you feel when people compare her directly to Lisbeth Salander? Because, I mean, obviously there are some similarities, but like you said, it's not really the same goal.
Well, you know, I have... a 3-month-old baby, and I live in the expensive area of the United States. I live in the Bay Area. So anyone who says my book's name and this is the Salander or the Golden Dragon Tattoo on the internet at the same time is doing me a great favor.
Okay.
Well, she'll type in Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and if my thing little pops up there on Google, great. So I don't care what you say about it. It's like, you know, spell my name right, M-A-M-A-T-A-S. Same thing with this. Get the names right, and they pops up. That's fine with me. I don't care who you compare it to. Also, I mean, just speaking more on a less mercenary level, once the book is out there, it belongs to whoever's reading it. So whatever
that's true.
To it, whatever however you like to interpret it, however you like to experience it, what you get off on in reading it is fine with me.
I
agree with you or tell you what the book's about, but, you know, that's totally fine
right.
with me.
We had a guest a while back who said that one of his creative writing teachers told him that anytime anybody ever asks you, did you do that on purpose about something in one of your books, you say yes, no matter what.
Oh, I always say, and I always tell my students, don't tell anybody anything. Say, I can't tell you. Because when I was a kid in 1989, this was the time when Salman Rushdie was gotten to all that controversy because of the fatwa against him by, I guess it was Khomeini, wanting him dead because he wrote the satanic verses. And I read a very interesting interview with him. It was probably in Granta magazine where he says, listen, I can't just go around and say, no, no, what I really meant was this. Because I'm a writer. I thought, oh, well, he's going to do that. And he's, you know, being threatened with death. And he has the security guards everywhere. And, of course, there were deaths involved. I think one of his translators was killed by someone. And somebody else might have been killed as well. And even he's not saying, okay, let me tell you what I really meant by the story. Let me explain my themes. Well, I'm not going to do it either.
I only ever had
some crank on Twitter saying, oh, come on, tell me.
I like that, though, because I only ever had one thing I've ever written that anybody cared enough about to comment on after the fact. And somebody was misinterpreting it. And I said, what was interesting, okay, is that the editor of the magazine that took it was involved in this online conversation that I was reading. And I went to be like, fuck you, dude, because the story was... Well, it was really sensitive subject matter, and so if you take it the wrong way, then I look like a really horrible person. But I was like, you know what? I wrote it. It's out there. The guy who loved it enough to publish it is talking to these people. I have to stay out of it because then it becomes like, you know, am I protesting too much or whatever? So I'm glad to hear that I made the right decision because sometimes
You can't win in that kind of encounter. So you may as well just stay out of it. What you can do when other people have their stories misinterpreted, then you can come in and say, well, you know, I read this story and I think it's this.
I do that with Jessica's
story. You can do my stories and I can do your stories, and then we'll be okay.
I rush to Jessica's stories defenses even when nobody is criticizing them. She mentions the story. I'm like, you know what? Anybody who doesn't like that story can kiss my ass.
It's awkward, actually, because they're like, no, I liked it, too.
I said, kiss my ass.
Exactly. There's no call for this violence, ma'am.
So one more book-related question before we get into listener questions, if you want to get them in.
Sure.
It was not really a question, really. It's just a moment that I wanted to relive with you. The scene where Dawn is recalling, like, the moment that she discovered punk rock has to be one of the coolest scenes in a book that I've read in a really long time. And I have to assume that you were into punk rock because I can't imagine it being represented that way by someone who's like, I hate that music.
I
don't know.
It was my experience as well. That was my same exact experience. Just turning it to the left of the door, what the hell is this? But, you know, it was pretty much it, and that was pretty amazing. I mean, I was quite young when punk came out, but I had at the time we were living in Brooklyn, my family was, and my mother's youngest brother was living with us for a time, and he'd go into Manhattan frequently to, he works as a waiter, and like all my brothers do, because we're Greek, and he'd come back with all these flyers and little tapes and little crazy records, and I just sort of absorbed them. It was just mind-blowing. But I was just a kid, so I didn't went off my back like water off a duck. Then when I rediscovered it in the late 80s, where it was something else, the hardcore was different. That was different than the sort of, you know, major label punk of the 70s. That was just another a mind-blowing thing.
He's like the same age as my husband. Like, we're closer in age, you know. And he told me that I should start listening to Loveline with, you know, Dr. Drew and at the time it was Adam Carolla, like, because he thought that if I didn't, I would go out and, like, get an STD or something. I don't know. So I started listening to it, and when it ended at midnight, that's when that local rock station's, like, punk guy came on. And so I literally ended up discovering punk because, like, I managed to stay up a few minutes later one night. And I didn't know what it was called or what it was about. And then someone's like, oh, yeah, that's punk. And I was like, oh, it has a name. That's fantastic. Anyway, I just had to share that because I love that scene. I thought it was so cool.
Well, thank you very much. And the sad thing is that's dead now. Right? That can't happen anymore because now with the internet, if you're curious about something, it's available for you instantly. So there's no secret moment of discovery. when you're all by yourself alone in a dark room, like, what the hell was that? That wasn't Donnie and Marie. That wasn't, you know, Britney Spears or Millie Vanilli or MC Hammer. Oh, my God. What's going on? It's like a secret world, because all the secret worlds now are all right on the surface.
So I never thought about that before right now, but you're right. Like, I think about, like, the discovery of my favorite bands, like, the first time I saw a music video or heard a record. And those are, like, important moments for me, but you're right. Like, if you're online, it tells you, like, this is the name of the band, this is the name of the song, this is the genre it's in, these are what everybody in the band looks like.
You can hear it again 25 times, you know. You can read all the fan fiction about the band or that kind of thing.
You used to have to write your own.
If you're... Yeah, if you're a producer, it's much better. Like, you can say, "Oh, I've discovered this thing. I can make my own and put it out in it, and everyone can hear it at once."
True.
So you lose something, but you also gain something.
So I'm going to start out with, I think, what's a really great question, considering some of the things we talked about at the top of the show.
Sure.
Teresa Scoltetti asks that she read somewhere that you said you would prefer to see your students put their own stories on their own web pages rather than give their work away to be published without payment elsewhere. And is that still your thinking or feeling on the subject? And would you please elaborate, as the comment did ring with some sarcasm? So,
well,
she just wants to know, like, what the idea
is. Yes, with a bunch of asterisks and caveats. Basically, the question was that I've been asked is, you know, I see people give their stories away to websites. So not even journals where you get a hard copy. You give them away to websites, and, of course, it's very easy to start a literary magazine. What you have to do is, you know, have HTML for Dummies on your lap and buy your domain and throw it up there, and you know, you're an editor. All right, woohoo. So what do you gain by giving your story to somebody to put up on their website?
Mm-hmm.
On rare occasions, when that person is a good editor and they've, you know, a good publisher and they've developed an audience, you can have a little bit of an audience. That's true. For the most part, though, most of those online magazines have no more readers than any normal blog does. So I think if you're a new writer, it's better off to just blog and tweet and Facebook a lot and get people interested in you and then put up your own story. Now, of course, what you really want to do is sell that short story to an anthology or a magazine that pays money and has readers and has a reputation. But if you can't do that, there's no reason to give it away to a non-paying market unless you're, you know, getting something else out of it. And for the most part, you're not getting anything else out of it. There are exceptions, of course. If you're a literary writer, it can make sense to do so because you're not really trying to get an audience. You're trying to get lines on your CV so you can get a job. So go ahead, give them away all the stupid literary journals that nobody reads. What you really want is health benefits, not a readership anyway. But if you're in the field where you can be paid and where you can have magazines and anthologies that have tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of readers, and that have a reputation, then, yeah, you should sell it to those. And if you can't sell your story to that, hang on to it. Just put it in your closet or put it in the trunk or put it in your email file. And then because there's a lot of churn. Right? Magazines come and go a lot. Anthologies come and go a lot. Hang on to your story. But if you're very desperate to put something out there or get something out there, go ahead, put it on your own website. Because you'll at least get all the benefits of or what small benefits there are in getting the readers out there. Now, of course,
that's true.
Now, because you can put things on Kindle. $1. And, you know, everyone's doing that now. It's very difficult to get any traction there because everyone's doing it. Unless you're writing, you know, werewolf meets Bigfoot, gay sex, orgy stories. Those are the big things now. It's difficult getting any sort of traction. But sure.
There's a lot of general erotica in the Kindle singles market as well. Whatever your thing is, you can find it there.
So there are many alternatives, but basically you should do what's best for you, meaning where the benefits accrue to you as opposed to accrue to somebody else, is what I'm saying.
Well, we had another question. I feel like it's in the same vein, but anyway, it's from Abby Mullins, and she says, what advice do you have for
aspiring writers? Is that a
real name? Abby Mullins.
Absolutely. Spell that last name.
M-U-L-L-E-N-S.
Oh, I thought you were saying Abby Mellons.
Oh, no. I just talk
like
funny.
Like a stripper name. That's like a stripper's name. Abby Mellons. No, I'm sorry, Abby Mellons. I apologize.
With the stripper demographic.
I didn't mean to make fun of your surname.
I
have a, my advice would be to read extremely widely and extremely deeply, and not as a fan and not as a reader, but as a writer. That is, don't just sit around reading those bad books because you kind of like them, whether they're rain candy or popcorn. Read the best books you possibly can in your genre and other genres, and read them deeply, mm-hmm. by which I mean read them for craft, for structure, for art, and try to figure out why things work, and just get heavily involved in reading. And that's really the best thing. I always tell my students, I teach here in Berkeley, California, and there is a way to walk to my class by New Path, a bookstore. And I always say, so what did you see in the bookstore today? And they say, well, I didn't go in. So you didn't go in, but you're a writer. How could you be a writer and walk across the bookstore and not go in?
Huh.
If you are a writer and you're walking by a bookstore, you're going to go in.
That's
and I happen to walk from across town, so I pass 5 bookstores. So I'd be an hour early because I go to all 5 bookstores every single week to see what's going on. Maybe I'll buy something available, but just to see what's up. Find something interesting, look around, poke around. If I see a book turned over on the gutter, I will take my shoe and flip it over to see what it is. If I see a homeless person reading a book, or a homeless person asleep with a book on his face, like a little tent, I will say, oh, what's this homeless guy looking at? What's he reading? Is it any good? Definitely. You can't help it. You have to cultivate that insatiable appetite for reading.
Uh-huh.
So that's going to really be where things come from. Now, once you do that, I would recommend keeping 2 things in mind. You want there is a false division between art and commerce, and these are not really in opposition. What you want to do is write artfully and for the sake of art, and then publish that art for money. You can't write for
money. I agree with you there.
That's not really possible. And you can't just say, I'm an artist. I can't possibly do anything that involves money. So you have to do both. So you're an artist when you're writing, and then when the writing is done and you're ready to submit, and you are a mercenary. You're looking to get maximum gain, maximum benefit for your place. And that maximum benefit may be small. If you're writing avant-garde poetry, it's going to be small, but still there's a hierarchy in this. You want to be the best avant-garde poet you can.
Mm-hmm.
Possible avant-garde poetry venues you can.
We are super short on time, so I want to. Her follow-up was, what is the advice that you hear often that you think is terrible advice?
Write every day. You don't have to write every day. Just write a lot. But take a day off. It's okay. There's no one's saying, oh, you spent a lot of time writing that. Nobody cares about that. They only care about the result.
And then James David Keaton wants you to follow him on Twitter, and Tom Pitts was very obliquely making fun of you, but like I said, we're running out of time.
Oh, is that the surname thing? Because actually, since I made fun of Abby a moment of the surname, I'll tell you that when I was a kid, people used to say, Momotas. That was the joke that had for my surname, which of course the joke was on them because it made them sound stupid. So,
yeah, it did.
Thank you, Tom Pitts. Yeah. And what's this guy's name? David James Keaton? James David Keaton?
David James Keaton.
You know, I always thought his name was James David Keaton. That's probably why I don't follow him, because I always like following the wrong person. Probably some other person I'm following by mistake. That's named James David.
You're following someone else inadvertently. And you're
like, I'm
to stop that.
His
Twitter is, I mean, I'm sure it's his name.
Spider Frog.
Like the little,
I'll
little
figure it out.
Thing.
What's this?
Spider Frog.
Number one wears off. I'll figure it out.
We just told everybody his Twitter, so everybody, Spider Frog.
He wants you to follow him,
that.
I promise.
It better be a good Twitter. It better be very entertaining.
It is. Highly worth it. Very funny. Very funny things going on that Twitter, I'm sure. Or he's never there. I honestly don't know. I don't check into Twitter very much.
Okay. We are super short on time, and we just want to mention again, we are being brought to you by Long Distance Drunks, the Charles Bukowski Anthology, by Perpetual Motion Machine Publishing. And as you just heard Nick say, anthologies are huge now. So you should go test that theory and see if you like anthologies as much as you should. Long Distance Drunks comes out on March 9th, and that's going to be linked up in the banner. And Nick's book, Love is Law, is out now. We will have it linked up. Once again, it'll be the photo. It'll be easy. All of the stuff we link that is in book form that Nick is involved with, it'll be a nice photo. And then there'll be
thank you very much.
Tons of links about everything we talked about, so make sure you check those out. Nick, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having you. It was great.
This was great. Thank
you. I love your show. I listened to about 17 episodes before I got on here.
Oh, Wow. We like to hear that.
That's cool. So you kind of, at least you kind of knew what you're getting into.